From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update of news and events from Central and South America and the Caribbean with Tony Solo, our reporter from south of the border, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Okay, let's start with the Pope.
Yeah, there's Pope Francis is making a visit, or has been making a visit to Chile, and is currently in Peru. The visit in Chile lasted 3 or 4 days. He visited indigenous peoples. He went to a women's prison. He did a mass, a public mass, and the main themes during his visit to Chile were indigenous peoples' rights, because he was expected to kind of give some kind of not necessarily outspoken backing, but some support to the rights of the Mapuche people in Chile. The Mapuche people are an indigenous group who have had their land taken over the last few centuries, first by the Spanish, then by the independence elites after Chile gained its independence. And through this century, they've also been facing, or over the last 80-100 years, they've been facing depredation from foreign corporate interests that are interested in their land. In the Mapuche people are probably, it's difficult to get reliable figures. It depends on how people define what the ethnicity of that group is. But, and you could say between 1 million and 1.5 million people in Chile are probably of Mapuche descent. And there's another significant population in Argentina as well. Some people say they're around 250,000. Some people say there are as many as 700,000 in Argentina. But anyway, they're a substantial indigenous group, a minority in both Chile and in Argentina. And the Pope was expected to make some kind of pronouncement in their favor, but he played that very low key. Presumably on the basis of some understanding with Michelle Bachelet, the Chilean president. The other theme that he was supposed to talk about from the point of view of public opinion was the issue of clerical sexual abuse by Roman Catholic priests in Chile, and the accusation that a very senior bishop in Chile had been covering up for those abuses. And he played that very low key. He upset some people because he defended the bishop who was accused of covering those abuses up. But in general, it's difficult to see if there's any significant balance from Pope Francis's visit, either in Chile or currently his visit in Peru, because all he seems to be saying is, it would be great if everybody would be nicer to each other, and you know. What kind of message is that?
Yeah, right. Yeah. It happens to be true, wouldn't it? But it doesn't exactly induce the desired condition just by expressing it. Hey, yeah, wouldn't it be? Well, you know, I mean, that's kind of what. that's what Trump said about being friends with Russia. Wouldn't it be nice? That's about as much policy as he articulated, and they're still all
I'm not being fair to Pope Francis, but I'm looked at from this distance. Peru has a huge Roman Catholic population. Something over 70% of the Peruvian population are quite strong Roman Catholics.
Right.
There's a less devoted population, Roman Catholic population in Chile. But it's a very important visit from that point of view, a very important visit in terms of promoting the idea of Latin America as and now there's this Latin American Pope, and he's paying serious attention to the very difficult problems facing Latin America. So yeah, I'm from a pastoral point of view, it was a very big deal for the Roman Catholic population in those countries, but somewhat controversial.
You know,
anyway,
there's something interesting about this. Why are you talking about Peru generally and this? You know, the Pope, the first Latin American Pope, there's now when he travels, there are certain, you know, framing of issues that go on in Latin America. For example, you know, in the United States, we had the same thing with the, you know, sexual abuse by the priests of, you know, young kids, mostly young boys, altar boys and such, and a cover-up. And it was very divisive issue inside the Catholic Church and over also over in the Vatican. You know, now we see, because this Pope is from the region, when he goes there, you know, this is something that's, you know, thrown in his face, because he was one of the people, you know, he's part of the establishment there while this was an issue. Other issues in Latin America also, watching the U.N. Security Council yesterday, they had a discussion about proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, not just nuclear weapons, but chemicals and ICBMs and all this stuff. And almost like the old days of Yugoslavia versus Albania, with you know, ideological discussion via proxy of the Soviet and China's camp, was Bolivia, on the one hand, speaking to the issue, and Peru now on the Security Council for this term, you know, sort of articulating the U.S. point of view on the Security Council, you know, couched in regional terminology and imagery. You know, Bolivia is very strong anti-war. You know, it's a zone of peace, you know, the whole situation there. That gets articulated on a global stage on a regular basis now. Almost any international question, Bolivia, you know, speaking out an independent position on the one hand, but also one that's born of the evolutionary process that's been ongoing in Latin America and South America in particular, with you know, sovereignty, independent course, you know, independent of the United States in particular. And so that gets articulated frequently in support of China, in support of Iran, in support of, you know, depending on who it is at the UN, by Bolivia. And now this year, we're seeing the counter-argument being made by Peru, which is now also on the world stage as a consequence of its membership on the Security Council. So we got the Pope kind of doing that, you know, inside the, you know, as far with the trappings of the Catholic Church and the role that that played, you know, kind of evokes the role that the Polish Pope, so-called, played in the 80s. And now also this, you know, sort of this drama that takes place at the UN. This is the second or third time I've seen it since the beginning of the year when Peru was sended.
Yeah, I don't want to get bogged down in the Pope's visit, because in overall terms, it was really kind of not of central importance in terms of the current issues facing Latin America, which sounds a strange thing to say. And the only exception to that, and one in the Pope's favor, and also related to the expectations of his advocacy and support of indigenous peoples in the region, is climate change. The Pope has been very, very clear that the climate change is a major problem and should be dealt with, taken very seriously, and in strong contrast to the position taken by most of the world's rich countries. And so in that regard, and that aspect of his visit is probably quite important. But on the whole, I don't think his visit is going to, it doesn't have any strong symbolic meaning or of change or significance. You know, it's difficult to think of anything very positive to say about that visit, except that he is definitely advocating on this visit in a very low-key way on behalf of the indigenous people and on behalf of ensuring that people take climate change seriously, which is very important. But anyway, and what you were just saying about Peru somehow curiously advocating or putting forward the United States point of view in terms of non-proliferation and non-aggression and all that, all those very, very, very fundamental international issues of just kind of getting along together, you know? Right. And that is also reflected in a meeting that's happening over the next, I think it started today and I think it finishes on Sunday. It's a meeting of the CELAC countries and China. And that's really, really important. There was a very, I put up on the site last night a very interesting interview, not because of it, it was a very extensive or deep interview with Alicia Bárcena, I think she's the director of the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, a UN body that develops policy and offers policy guidance and tries to coordinate policy initiatives in the region to promote the economic development of the region. Now, she's essentially a strong social democrat, taking strong, very, very conventional economic policy positions in terms of her policy recommendations. But it's really interesting to see how she is absolutely clear that unless Latin America operates as a bloc and in its dealings with the world, and in particular with major economic powers, leading global economic powers like China, they're not going to be able to get the best deal for the peoples of the region. So she's strongly advocating that CELAC works for more integration, in particular on policy, and in particular on economic policy, and taking steps, for example, to improve the skills exchange, knowledge exchange, exchange of technology, which she says is a very strong component of China's overall economic development package and the package that it offers its potential partners, in strong contrast, of course, to the United States and the European Union, who tend to be very mean about technological exchange. Alicia Bárcena was also very clear that Latin America will not be doing the best for its people if its economic policy isn't geared to diversifying away from simple raw materials exports with no value added. And that people have been saying that for decades now.
Right.
But the difference now is that Latin America has a potential partner in China.
That's right.
And in other Asian countries that is interested in that kind of technological development, scientific development, an exchange of knowledge, helping its partners diversify so that they become more attractive partners to China itself.
Right, and part of the diversification, first of all, is the diversification of options for Latin America from the Monroe Doctrine model, which is essentially, okay, we have a gun pointed at your head, we're taking your stuff, sit down and shut up, you keep a gun trained on them. That's basically the model that's been followed. Now that's changing. China is engaging there, and apparently this CELAC was meeting also in Chile, right?
Santiago de Chile.
And apparently Argentina and Chile are the two, sort of the keys to this process, whether they're going to be, even though you have right-wing governments more or less now in each of the two places, can they stake out an independent course for their own countries? And like we've said before, kind of this model of, independence, of, exerting their sovereignty, of charting their own course, of economic consolidation, that has brought back rewards that are so compelling that even the right-wing governments have been compelled to follow that model many ways. And so is that what's going to, are the potential benefits of doing business with China in a win-win situation so compelling that even the right-wing governments installed by the U.S. will see it as, preferable to dealing with the U.S.?
Yeah, and this brings us back to what you were saying earlier. Like Peru advocating positions of the United States on certain global issues, but its core interests, its core economic interests, depend on how well it develops its relationship with China and the other Asian countries. Because And all it's going to, it's the only relationship, it's as you just pointed out, the only relationship it's going to develop with the United States is the traditional looting relationship that the United right. States has always imposed on Latin right. American countries. Right. So there's this deep contradiction. Now, Alicia Bárcena is a very smart woman, but I think, and she has these ideological limitations. So, for example, she'll say Latin American countries have to do more to integrate with China and deal with China if they're going to make real changes to benefit their populations. But, and when she says that, and she'll say the countries that have done most to promote that are the Pacific Alliance countries, but that's not true. The country that has done most to promote its relation, and the two countries that have done most to promote their relations with China, are Venezuela and Cuba.
Right.
Now why? So why is Alicia Bárcena saying, you know, that the Pacific Alliance countries are the ones that have done most to develop their relationship with China? She's saying that because her model is a capitalist model, you know, tending towards free trade, traditional economic theory, the idea that free markets tend to equilibrium. You know, this is what is so strange about so many of the individuals who often have a very positive contribution to make, but they have these insane beliefs that, you know, the free markets don't tend to equilibrium.
Right.
How can anybody still believe that?
Right. You have to look at history. Look at history. How do we have such a lack of equilibrium?
Sorry, the only reason I mention that is because this demonstrates how actually revolutionary what Venezuela is trying to do. It really is.
Yep.
Because it's like cognitive dissonance. What is that, the phrase, cognitive dissonance?
Yes.
Alicia Bárcena, this very talented, very smart woman with lots of positive contributions to make in terms of Latin America's development, she just can't recognize or isn't prepared to recognize publicly the revolutionary change that Venezuela's model has brought to Latin America. And in a very positive way.
Right.
And what she's saying about Latin American unity is exactly what Cuba and Venezuela, Bolivia, Evo Morales, Rafael Correa in Ecuador before he had to stand down as president in Ecuador. And all these progressive leaders are pushing for precisely what Alicia Bárcena's arguing for: regional integration, right. Closer regional integration, a unified policy in order to deal with leading global economic powers like China and the European Union, let alone the United States. But when it comes to the nitty-gritty, and her public statements reflect the conventional, insane, false beliefs.
Right. You know, this is an argument that's been ongoing. I mean, what she's basically doing is exhibiting what is often done by some people that are characterized perhaps as ultra-leftists. I wouldn't use the term myself. But, you know, basically ideological dogmatism, that you're so blinded by a hook of some ideological point that you can't see the forest for the trees, or even the trees. It's the same way with those that criticize Venezuela from the left, by the way, which is not what I'm saying she's doing. And that is, they fail to see the point that you're raising, which is true. On the fundamental question of imperialism in Latin America, which has been the biggest stumbling block to its development, the model that Venezuela has helped to flesh out, along with Cuba, and then with the ALBA countries, and then in the larger constructs, including CELAC and others, is independence from U.S. imperialism, which has been the main problem for a century and change there. And yeah. That solving that problem opens up the possibilities of everything else. Not solving that yeah. problem means that you continue in that condition and nothing is possible.
Yeah, and one of the issues about these right-wing countries, and the president of Peru is this right-wing guy, Kuczynski. You have Mauricio Macri in Argentina. You're going to have Sebastian Piñera soon in Chile. you're going to have another right-wing president almost certainly in Colombia. Who knows what? While we're talking about this, what you're talking about is when Hugo Chavez was alive, he, Daniel Ortega, when Fidel was still alive, and now Raul has taken over from Fidel, and somebody new will take over from Raul with very little change in the overall regional policy from Cuba. But what they're saying is, it doesn't matter what our ideological differences are. We've got to work together through CELAC to build a unified policy position for Latin America that's going to benefit all our peoples.
Right.
And so what the right wing are doing is they're sabotaging that. CELAC has been virtually it's been kind of neutralized in terms of activity, except for these kinds of trade and economic policy summits that are crucially important even to the right wing. But the undercurrent at the moment, as a result of the coming to power of these right wing leaders in the soft coup against Dilma Rousseff, Mauricio Macri taking power in Argentina, Kuczynski in Peru, the right wing continuing power in Colombia. Now, someone I regard as an extreme right winger coming to power in Chile. What that means is that they tend to, because they are so split in their loyalties. On the one hand, they feel a strong attraction to, and they have strong loyalties to their U.S. kind of bosses, if you like,
right.
In the region, but at the same time they recognize that their own material interests demand that they look towards Asia, especially China.
Right.
So what's happening is that in terms of the regional integration, the political initiatives in the region, those have been kind of put on ice for the moment. But the trade initiatives, the economic policy initiatives, they tend to move forward. And you can see that, for example, in the way the Pacific Alliance countries are trying to revive the Trans-Pacific Partnership that Trump abandoned shortly after taking office. And I think China is trying to work with the countries that had hoped to participate in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. China is trying to kind of coax them into working, into developing a similar kind of agreement that includes China, which the Trans-Pacific right. Partnership didn't.
Specifically so, didn't, right.
Yeah, so that whole kind of bundle of kind of contradictions is one that's actually very debilitating for the region, and I think that's really what Alicia Bárcena was trying to talk about in that interview that she gave to Xinhua, the Chinese news agency.
Right. Although she was riddled with the same contradictions that she's essentially, you know, describing or that exist in any event as context for our conversation.
Yeah. Yep. So looking at that, and what might change that? Well, this year there's the possibility of some change. We don't know how likely those possibilities are going to be. I think it might help to give people a quick run through the schedule of elections this year. Do you think that's a good idea?
Yeah, we got about 5 minutes. Let's do that.
Okay. So on February the 4th, Costa Rica has its presidential election. There's unlikely to be a major change in Costa Rica, although the political scene there is much more confused than it used to be, because the traditional parties, that there used to be a basically two-party system there, and that's broken down. So, and there might be a surprise in Costa Rica, but it's very unlikely that they're likely to change their regional policy. Whoever wins the presidency in February, and in fact, it's likely to go to a second round. I think the second round is sometime towards the end of March, because it's very unlikely that any candidate is going to get an outright majority on the first round. Then, as you pointed out when we had our last conversation, the Colombian parliament the Colombian parliamentary elections are on March the 11th,
right.
And they could be very important. There could be some change in a similar way to there was some change in the Chilean parliament in the legislative elections in Chile last year. There may be more representation of social democrat leaning parties in Colombia. But the difficulty in Colombia is that Colombia is a country with something like, I think it's got 32 departments composed in total of over 1,100 municipalities. Now, of those 1,100 municipalities, over 270 are outright controlled by paramilitaries.
Ouch.
And those 275 municipalities are spread through something like 27 of the country's 32 departments.
Ouch.
So that makes... You know, that makes complete nonsense of kind of democratic process in Colombia, which in any case, the parliamentary elections there, the whole political system, apart from the paramilitary influence, is notoriously corrupt. So then Colombia has its presidential elections on May the 27th, and it's unlikely that the extreme right wing, somebody sympathetic to Álvaro Uribe, will win. There'll probably be another kind of center-right president similar to Juan Manuel Santos. Very unlikely that a left-wing candidate will make any headway at all. But I mean, that's that Colombian context, we need to talk about that in another program because there's so much to talk about.
All the other stuff going on there too. But yeah, go ahead, next. Yeah. Yep.
Then in Paraguay, April the 22nd, that's what I saw. And up until recently, there was some doubt about when the presidential elections would be in Paraguay, but it's likely that a left-wing candidate similar to Fernando Lugo, because the crucial thing in all these elections, if the left-wing's going to do well, they have to combine. They can't let their differences split their vote. And in Paraguay, they seem to have learned that lesson. The left progressive parties are going into that election on pretty much a broad united ticket, and they're likely to win. We'll see.
Right.
The same in Mexico. In Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the kind of historic loser in Mexico, the historic victim of one fraudulent election after another, he looks as though he's leading the polls now, and he might very well win in Mexico, which would be a huge turnaround, a huge kind of upset, especially from the point of view of somebody like President Trump. So and quite positive results possible in Paraguay and Mexico. And in Brazil, everything turns on a decision that's going to be taken over the next few days in one of the superior courts in Brazil. It's one of the appeal levels that President Lula still has open to him. If the decision goes against him, that also is very complicated. There are all kinds of footnotes to add to that. But if the decision does go against him, it could complicate his candidacy for the presidential elections that are scheduled for October.
Right.
And in Venezuela, the presidential elections are likely to be sometime in December. Right. So in Brazil, everything turns, and I don't think that's an exaggeration. And everything in Brazil does turn on whether Lula da Silva will be able to run in the presidential elections.
Right.
Because if he can't, it's difficult to see how Brazil's going to overcome its current crisis and the current offensive, the right-wing offensive against people's basic rights in Brazil. And in Venezuela, the crucial thing is the government going to be able to bring prices under control? The consensus among people I know in Venezuela seems to be that the only thing that is going to allow the opposition and its United States backers to get what they want in Venezuela is if people finally give up because they can no longer tolerate the price inflation and speculation that the government hasn't been able to bring under control. But if the government does bring substantive measures into play to control prices in Venezuela, then I think there's no doubt at all that Nicolas Maduro will be reelected in December.
Yep. Yeah, and Lula is well ahead in the last poll. There was a poll done in late December in Brazil. I'd like to thank you for your time again and to speak with you again next week.
Yeah, okay. Thanks a million, Don. If we can, we should try and talk more about Colombia as well.
Yeah, we'll do that. Thanks a lot. Take care. And that's all the news we have for you right now.
For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.